You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. Since Michelin began publishing restaurant guides more than a century ago, it's gone to extraordinary lengths to keep the identities of its restaurant reviewers secret. Its guiding principle is that only anonymous, professionally trained experts can be trusted for accurate assessments of food and service. But earlier this year, Michelin allowed New Yorker staff writer John Colapinto to meet and dine with one of its reviewers and get a firsthand look at how those coveted three-star ratings are awarded. His article, Lunch with M, is in the November 23rd issue of The New Yorker, the magazine's food issue. And I'm pleased that it brings him to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Hi.
Hi, Amy.
After all these years of secrecy, what changed? Why did Michelin allow you to meet and lunch with an inspector?
I'm incredibly good at talking people into things. No. I like to think so. But no, I think it was largely because the New York City Guide was launched 5 years ago. And I think it's been less of a hit than Michelin was hoping for in New York. New Yorkers, in New York, everyone's a critic. And I think the Zagat Guide is extremely popular. The New York Times has an amazing reputation for its reviews. And I think Michelin's, looking to get in there, and they had to do something big and unprecedented.
You ate at Jean Georges with the inspector whom you called Maxime, not her real name. Will she ever eat there again?
No, I'm told that she can't do it. She certainly can't do it as an inspector. I mean, they're so careful about keeping these people's identities secret that the mere fact that she's shown her face there with Jean-Luc Naret, the director of the guides, means that the staff there could put two and two together and say, maybe she's an inspector. So I was told, no, she cannot eat there again as an inspector.
Did M ever tell you her real name?
No, she sure didn't. There was not even... Not even on deep background. No, it was amazing. She wouldn't tell me what sort of town she came from north of the city. She wouldn't tell me what state she'd been working in before she started working for Michelin. I mean, it was amazing how secretive she was.
You write that she doesn't even tell people what she does for a living. It sounds like working for the CIA. Why such a high level of secrecy?
She'll lose her job if it somehow gets back to restaurants who she is or what she does. And, she really she loves what she does. She wants to keep that job. And I think Michelin does recognize that in this day and age where it's extremely difficult for newspaper reviewers, for instance, to maintain anonymity. Because don't forget, these restaurants are looking for these critics. They are trying to find them. I mean, they're following people like Frank Bruni down the street trying to get a good photograph of his face when he was a New York Times critic. So she knows the restaurants want to know who she is, and she's not going to do anything to help them.
What kind of training did she get? Taste training?
I asked about that. I wondered if that was the case. And not so much taste training, I don't think. It was learning the Michelin system, certainly. This is a woman... And any Michelin inspector is already obsessed with food. They already are probably extremely good tasters of food, very good at distinguishing flavors one from another in a mixture. I think that's possibly inborn. There's certainly a theory that that's the case. I think what Michelin really does is give them extensive training in looking at a restaurant the way Michelin does, judging the creativity of the food, judging the sort of degree of freshness and quality of the products that are used in the food. They also, of course, assess the ambience of a restaurant. That training is extensive. I mean, I was just amazed at the months of training that go on, and they flew the New York inspectors to France for 2 weeks, and then from there they had to go to another European city for a few weeks or months, and then they come back to New York, and before they're released into the field to actually do their work, they have to go through yet more training, eating with senior inspectors and writing reports. I mean, it's almost crazy.
I'm speaking with John Colapinto, the staff writer for The New Yorker, about his article, Lunch with M. He lunched with an inspector for the Michelin Guide, the coveted Michelin restaurant guide. And we're talking about food on this eve before Thanksgiving, a holiday centered around food. John, an inspector's life, as M describes it, sounds rather lonely. She eats out two times a day, lunch and dinner, and she eats alone. Why?
Yeah, she eats alone in order to really concentrate on the food. I think she found it somewhat agonizing that when we were eating at Jean Georges, I kept saying to her, you know, what are you looking at when you look at the menu? And she said, you know, now this is exactly why I can't eat with somebody when I do my work.
You're interrupting me. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, they are just laser-like on the menu, on what's on the plate. And I do believe it probably would be too distracting. Interestingly, though, she did say, and I think I didn't work this into the article, that when they eat in three-star restaurants, which is the highest-rated type of restaurant, they always go with another inspector or two because it looks too suspicious to have a person dining alone.
I was going to say, Now that this is out there, that inspectors for the Michelin Guide dine alone, I would think that the first thing a restaurant would do is look for somebody intensely focused on their food all by themselves.
I have to say I kind of agree. I mean, there may be certain clues in my article that restaurants may look for. And certainly the ones, I think, one-star restaurants, which are, you know, in any universe, extraordinarily fine restaurants, I believe they can eat alone in those. So, yes, maybe my article's going to make their job a little harder.
Does she take notes?
No, she does not, because you cannot be seen to be writing stuff. As she said to me, she can remember a meal that she ate 10 years ago.
Wow.
Like right down to the individual ingredients, she said. When I expressed surprise at that, she said, well, it's probably the same way as you remember things that you read 10 years ago. And it's true. I mean, I'll have stray phrases that I loved from a beautifully written book that stick in my head because I'm a writer. And I think that's really the way it is for these food, you know, severe foodies.
Hmm. When does she write up her report and what goes in it?
It sounds like Em is very disciplined. She writes her reports right afterward. And I did hear from the director of the guides, Jean-Luc Naret, that some of the inspectors can wait a few days and sometimes have to because they're so busy. She's very disciplined. She gets right on it. And they actually work from a pre-printed form of categories and classifications that they fill in. And I think there is, again, they were a little vague on this. They didn't want their sort of secrets too much revealed to me. But I believe that there's scope also for her to write sort of essay-like notes in the report. But apparently, you know, they're extensive reports. It can take her 2 to 3 hours to fill one out if she's been at a really great restaurant like Jean Georges.
You mentioned that for all its prestige, the Michelin Restaurant Guide hasn't really caught on here. And you talked about the New York Times and the Zagat Restaurant Survey being more the arbiters of taste and taste here in New York City. Why is that?
You know, I think it's partly that people see the Michelin Guide and think it's some kind of cabal of French people that came here and are snootily judging American, you know, restaurants.
Well, that was true in 2005, right? Wasn't it a team of French inspectors that wrote the initial guide?
Yes, exactly. And that was just the first guide. They had not yet established a base here. They brought over inspectors from Europe. And I think that first guide indeed reflected that it was Europeans. But they were busily recruiting and training their American inspectors. They have a Tokyo guide where they use people from Tokyo to do the judging. So they do try to make these things indigenous to the place. I think, you know, the original Michelin guide in France took many years, decades really, to assume the remarkable power it now has in France and I guess Europe at large. And I think it might just be a matter of time for this guide to kind of seep in and for people to realize just how kind of authoritative it is. And, you know, I was somewhat sold on it. I thought this is a remarkable product that they put out every year.
You described the criticism against Michelin as a fussy French guide wedded to this idea of formal technical accuracy versus a visceral emotional reaction to a restaurant's food. Is that fair? I mean, after all, chefs at the very top of their game, shouldn't they be judged on things like technique and consistency and not just, ooh, they do a really great escargot?
I think they should be judged on those things. They are charging an extraordinarily large amount of money for their food. And, you know, it's really frank. Let me see now who actually made that criticism. Someone, a food critic, made that criticism in my piece. It's in the typical journalistic style.
I think it was Bruni.
Yeah, I think it was Bruni. And, you know, I think, you know, someone like Frank, who's dined out so widely, much more so than I have, you know, he probably has the expertise to say that there's sort of a quality of soulfulness that might be missing from the Michelin guide. But Michelin doesn't claim to be at least in its star system, it doesn't claim to be zeroing in on soulfulness or ambience or anything. You know, they are rigidly, strictly, and maybe this is rather a French thing, they're zeroing in on these kind of variables of quality of product, accuracy of cooking, sort of the science of cooking. You know, I think people are can legitimately say that's a little, you know, that's missing the boat somehow. But I think, you know, I think it's an, let me just put it this way. I think it's a fascinating way to look at food. And having now dined at Jean-Georges and seen what this, and tasted what this fellow does, I can see why it's a legitimate way to go about it.
The World has heard from another inspector besides your M. In 2004, French Michelin inspector Pascal Remy published a book that really scandalized the restaurant world. Describe his beef with Michelin.
Yeah, it's interesting how why it's scandalized, too, because, you know, he really, in some ways, it looks like such mild criticism in a way. I mean, he certainly described the inspector's life as being one of sort of homesickness and drudgery. It's particularly tough, I think, on French inspectors. They cover the whole country of France, and they are in a car, and they are driving around. They are away from their families night after night. You know, these city guides that they've since launched for Tokyo and New York and so on, at least the inspector lives at home and, you know, strikes out during the day to these restaurants. But he also said, and what was, I guess, somewhat scandalizing, was that he claims that Michelin is not being entirely accurate when it says that these stars are earned every year through consistency of cooking. He claims that certain huge giants of French cooking, like Paul Bocuse, are in fact getting something of a free ride. He claims that, you know, the inspectors knew that the quality had declined at Bocuse over 45 years, and yet he held on to his three-star ranking. He also said, hey, listen, there's way less inspectors than Michelin has hinted at. There was only five by the time Pascal Remy left Michelin, whereas people had thought there was, you know, scores more than that. The implication being they cannot possibly revisit these restaurants as often as they say.
And what were the repercussions of these claims? How did Jean-Luc Naret defend Michelin?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, those criticisms and that book of Remy's happened to come out in the very year that the then director of the guides, a man named Derek Brown, which in itself was somewhat scandalous because he was English. He was the first Englishman as opposed to Frenchman to be director of the guides. He happened to have reached his mandatory retirement age. So he sort of accepted a little bit of the fallout and gave sort of an anemic response saying, well, why would we lie about the number of stars? You know, we would only get letters from restaurant eaters, which didn't seem like a strong defense against Remy's charges. But then he left, and then Michelin, interestingly, hired someone from outside the company. They had never done that before. They'd always hired someone that had come up through being an inspector and being an editor of the guides and then eventually made director of guides. So Jean-Luc Naret, who's suave and, you know, nicely spoken, good-looking guy, sort of came in to put a happier, perhaps, PR face on things, and also is more open. They'd always been like the Kremlin at Michelin. They didn't answer any questions. Naret, you know, you ask him how many inspectors there are in, you know, America, he'll say 10, or, you know, he'll just throw out the number. He's not afraid to do that.
Do you think this new openness is directly a result of Remy's book?
You know, I do, and I think it was not just Remy's book. I think there was a suicide of a much beloved, much praised chef, Bernard Loiseau, I guess the year before Remy's book came out. And that, you know, it had certainly been rumored. This man, Loiseau, had sort of put unbelievable emphasis on getting a three-star ranking for his restaurant, Côte d'Or. And he, you know, struggled for decades to get that. He went up from one star to two star, and eventually was bestowed the three stars. When it started to be rumored that he might lose one of those stars within sort of the infighting, you know, backstabbing foodie world in France, he went into a depression. Now, he already had a history of depression, but this certainly didn't help. And he eventually committed a suicide. And so Remy's book sort of came out when this cloud of already hung over Michelin, this idea that, hey, you know, you're sending out these anonymous people that aren't even showing their faces, and their judgments on these chefs can have really profound repercussions. And Remy wasn't the first suicide. There had been one back in the 60s. And so, I mean, you know, it's kind of a lighthearted story, the Michelin Guide, until you really look at the extraordinary emphasis that these particularly French chefs in France place upon the guide because it means dollars and cents to them. You get a 3-star ranking, you know, you get these huge people, you know, a huge bump up in your revenues.
Do you think French and 3-star restaurant trained chefs who work in the States, like Jean-Georges and Daniel Boulud, think about Michelin differently?
I think they used to think about it differently 5 years ago because Michelin didn't exist here. And then it came here. And what all of those chefs, I talked to three or four French chefs here that have been working here for years, what they expressed to me was kind of a doubleness. They were, on the one hand, all along, they were kind of disappointed that they would never be judged by Michelin because there wasn't a Michelin guide here. And then when they heard the Michelin guide was coming, they were, on the one hand, excited. And on the other hand, they felt that kind of oppressive weight of, oh, boy, they're here, you know? Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah, it was fun.
Yeah.
Do you think you have what it takes to be a Michelin inspector?
Myself?
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm a solitary writer alone in a room a lot of the time, which these guys have to be. I travel a fair amount. Yes, I'm going to leave the New Yorker for Michelin.
John Colapinto is the author of Lunch with M, which appears in the November 23rd issue of the New Yorker. Thanks so much for joining us this afternoon on the Leonard Lopate Show, and have a great Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Amy.